The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I will apologize for probably having to clear my throat a bit more often than usual, as I'm just finishing recovery from a cold. But I'd like to talk today about remembering the way of peace, which seems came to mind as a good topic at this Festival of Remembrance on Veterans Day. Which is, of course, a big transfer of merit ceremony from our Buddhist practice for the benefit of all beings, the people, the animals, all who have died in wars throughout history and in wars going on at the present time. And as Buddhists, we remember not only the fallen veterans of our own families and countries, but as Reverend Master Daishin mentioned in his dedication, also all beings of all places, no matter what side they fought on, as there was tremendous suffering and death on the part of so many, many people in even just the wars within the last century, as well as the countless number of animals that died. All those who became victims of war and violent strife, we offer merit and any blessings from our practice for them on this day. And we remember and appreciate the sacrifice, if you'd like to use that word, or the offering that they made, which in some way, whether we agree with it or not, is a great offering. And I would like to venture to say, perhaps at heart, in their deepest heart, an offering towards peace, however confused that may sometimes become. This occasion and looking at the news from time to time certainly causes me to reflect deeply on and take refuge in the first noble truth of the Buddha, that suffering does exist. And I find great comfort and solace in that reflection. It's nothing new. It's been going on for some time, and we can do something about it. And that's the good part of all of this. Perhaps it can be a motivator to doing something about ourselves. And so I think it's important to not only remember the tragedies and the offerings of those who died, but also to remember what is it that actually is conducive to peace, with a capital P. What cultivates peace? We all have had some experience of this, and we all actually know something about it, perhaps more than we care to admit. Peace of heart and mind, peace in body, speech and mind. For as the Buddha and all the great masters have taught, peace in the world comes forth from a peaceful heart or mind. And I find this a very liberating truth, that there's always something that we can do when we feel helpless in the face of the wars that are happening, the conflict and strife that is happening. We feel frustrated or troubled by it. We can use that to motivate us to do something about ourselves and to find peace in our hearts. And that's where all true peace originates, as I just said. And we can prove this true through our practice. Perhaps one way of referring to the way of peace is actually the middle way, which the Buddha taught, between the extremes of aggression and laziness or passivity, extreme passivity. And you name it, you can go through a list of those extremes. But we find those extremes in our daily lives as well. Walking that middle way is truly the path of peace that I have found for myself. in the bylaws of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, our order, that we're all practicing in, under the section on religious teachings and practices of our order, there's one section that states the fundamental teachings and practices that we follow. Now, I'm speaking here simply as one monk of our order, from my own understanding, of course. And I had cause to reflect on this when I thought about the way of peace, because for me, these fundamental teachings of our order are actually an expression of that middle way, that way of peace. One expression. There are many ways to express it. Here's a quote from those bylaws. So it says, the religious teachings and practices of our order are broadly defined to include the following elements, and I won't read them all. The basic principles of Buddhism, common to most schools thereof. And here's the part I wanted to bring out. The fundamental teachings and practices of the Manzan line, our particular lineage, of serene reflection, meditation, Buddhism, as exemplified by Koho Zenji, Reverend Master Jiu, I'm abbreviating here, in accordance with the direct Dharma transmission from the Buddhas and ancestors. These teachings and practices include primarily, number one, the practice of serene reflection meditation, in Japanese called zazen, or shikantaza, just sitting practice. Number two, the keeping of the 16 precepts. Number three, the principle that all beings are at heart Buddha. And number four, gratitude. And I won't read the whole thing, but I was remembering at a time when I was having a lot of difficulty and my faith was weak. Reverend Master Koten, as it happens, came along and reminded me of these basic fundamental practices of our order. And I found them so helpful and have kept them in mind as a foundational reflection for myself. Just to remember that there is a way, as his invocation also states in the Vesak invocations. Yes, oh yes, there is a way. And I think this reflection is important at a time when we're also thinking about sad things that have happened. There is a way out of the sorrow and the suffering. And so let's look at this particular expression a little bit more, our expression of this way of peace, or the middle way. We can, at least in my experience, forget the tremendous treasures that we have available to us at all times, as well as what we have to offer those who have died in wars and conflict, those steeped in deep suffering, even in our present time. We have these treasures at hand all the time. It's easy to forget, but this remembering can change our perspective within an instant. It can shift our perspective to something that we can positively do at any moment of the day and any time. First, the practice of serene reflection meditation, which we all know about, or most of us, Zazen. When I first came to the Abbey in 1973, September, for a month's retreat, as part of that retreat, we sat a week-long session retreat for the first time, or I did for the first time, and I remember halfway through that retreat this sense of peace and ease that came into my heart and mind. I won't say that it was accompanied by a great fanfare or anything dramatic, but it was unmistakable. And it told me that this is what I was really looking for in my, you know, usual ups and downs of adolescence. I was in my early 20s then, although I did have some rough times. And again, they caused me to search for the Dharma at an early age. And so I had a definite sense of peace in a way that was unmistakable and that I knew I could completely rely on, although at that time I had absolutely no idea where it would lead me. In later years, I might have thought of this peace with a capital P as perhaps a sense of the certainty of the unborn, the undying, the unchanging. Or sometimes it's just the simple acceptance of a difficult situation that I can't do anything about, and just not being as hard on myself as I might be want to do. Anything in that range can bring peace. However small it is, I think it's good to acknowledge it, whether it's within ourselves or within a group of people. Whenever we experience it, I think it's good to acknowledge it and bow to it. We tend to see the problems easily, but we don't always see and acknowledge the peace that's there. So the simple practice of sitting still in the midst of all conditions, as our meditation practice has us do, not trying to think, not trying not to think, not grasping after things, not pushing them away. In itself, for me, and I have heard this from many others, is a source of great liberation in itself. Truly doing this is already a great step towards liberation. And I firmly believe, and I've certainly seen in my own life, by practicing this myself, I may not always have the outcomes that I would like to have or expect in my relationships and in the world around me, but always it leads towards something good. It has this way of doing the best for everyone, as Great Master Keizan says. It does the best for everyone. And so I think it's important to cultivate a faith that this practice and the ripples of it extend limitlessly in all directions, and that even if the results are not apparent in this life or in this day or next month or next year, that in some life it will bear fruit and be of benefit to not only ourselves but others. Certainly we've all had some experience of this already in our own training, and yet we have to actively cultivate a trust and faith in that and keep it going. Great Master Dogen says in his Rules for Meditation, if you become thus utterly free, you will be as the water wherein the dragon dwells, or as the mountain whereon the tiger roams. We've heard this many, many times. Think about that. That's huge. I remember hearing, upon reflecting also on this today and yesterday, hearing Reverend Master Jiu's teaching. I think it was on a Dharma tape, a series of talks she gave probably to the monks or somewhere along the line in her teaching. And the words still light up in my mind every so often. You know, we all have these sayings that come to mind now and then, big red letters flashing at us saying, well, this one is where she says, be content. Do not create opposites where they don't exist. Well, that really has stuck with me, and I needed to hear that at the time. But it comes to me every so often, and again, is one of these foundational reflections for me in my daily thoughts and actions. Just noticing when how often my mind attempts to do this, you know, this impulse to create opposites. Just by noticing it, our grasp on it is loosened, and by not going there, we're immediately freed of it. So this is, I think, a very important part of our meditation, and one of the great benefits is seeing how the mind creates these opposites. And really, at least for me, if you think about this, even on a day-to-day level, you know, those people over there doing that which we don't like, or we don't like the way they look or the way they talk or whatever it is, or why don't they do things the way we do, if this becomes an entrenched idea, a habit of mind, you can imagine how it does actually lead in ultimately to conflict and strife and perhaps war and killing each other. And if you really reflect on these things, you can see that it doesn't take that much to start a war, you know. So the more we practice, and being kind to ourselves, of course, in the process, the more we're chipping away at those, I think, collective impulses also to harm each other. as a sort of convoluted way of creating peace or of making a better world. Well, the second one is the keeping of the 16 precepts. I won't go into detail on each of them, as that's a huge subject. The precepts, the great liberators, as we call them, as it says in the scripture of Brahma's net, these are our great guides through and beyond all manner of sorrow and strife, and something that we can completely rely on, something that points us to the purity of our heart and the purity of all hearts of all beings. In the three pure precepts, which summarize our 16 precepts, we promise to cease from evil, to do as little harm as possible, as we know it at the present time. It doesn't mean we have to be perfect. It means that for today, I can see that such and such may cause harm, and I will do something about myself in order to not cause that harm. And each day that might change, or from year to year that might change. It's very important, I think, to see the precepts in light of the present time, our present training today. And we don't become too perfectionistic, too worried about ideals. But think about that, just to reflect on not doing harm right there. Again, helps with those impulses to perhaps, step on that bug that you don't have to step on. You could just escort it off the path, right? Or to strike out at our child when in fact we could just give him a hug and say, okay, you know, we know you're really hungry, but we have to get home now. You know, all those times. Or say something mean to our spouse or to our friends. Second one, doing only good. Again, at the present time, doing what I know to be good. What seems good to do here? You know, using that as a reflection. It's not what's perfect. It's not what necessarily even the Buddha would have done or somebody else would have done, but what seems good for me to do right here, given the circumstances. And it means that we can always take a step forward. Once we clear away something of the harmfulness, then the way to doing good opens up. There's always a step forward, even if it's just the next step going up on the cloister. Once you take that step, with each step, as I see it, the landscape changes. So it points to not being too attached to our views. And then the third one, being doing good for others. Dogen, Great Master Dogen's commentary on this says, let us be beyond the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves and others. Think of the holy wars, if you like, you know, what we called holy wars in the past. And let us pray that as Buddhists we won't cause that sort of conflict and strife in people's, in anywhere, you know, even in our communities. And the unholy, obviously being reckless with ourselves and others. Let's be beyond the holy and the unholy and just do the very best we can, considering the effects on others, considering what is not just good for us, but also good for all beings and into the future. And the third of these basic practices of our order being the principle that all beings are at heart Buddha. And I really love that. I know when I was working as a tutor for some time out in the world, I had to make some money to pay off some debts at one time, and that interrupted my being at the Abbey for a period of time. And I used this as my little foundational reflection when I went to tutor. Maybe some of you do that with your clients or your patients, your students. All beings are at heart Buddha. It makes quite a difference in the way that you approach people and in the way that you approach helping others as well. It's so easy to take over other people's lives inadvertently when we're trying to help them. And think of, you know, how many wars have inadvertently started that way. You know, we've got the great way. Don't they want to do it too? Let's push it on them, you know. Perhaps that's not accurate, but, you know, it seems like we can go there. I know that my mind can go there when I think something is a great idea and I'm trying to convince somebody else of it. We can get quite irritated and annoyed, and before you know it, we're into a fight when we started out just wanting to help somebody. If we reflect sincerely on all beings are at heart Buddha, in my experience, it causes all manner of ills to evaporate. It doesn't mean that everybody knows this all the time. It could be that they're really struggling. Could be that we're really struggling. But just to have the faith that at heart all beings are Buddha. At heart, we all have the same wish, the same suffering, the same wish for peace, the same wish to love and be loved. And that deals with so many difficulties right there if we make that a practice of reflection. And this is a particularly strong element of our Soto Zen tradition, that all beings are at heart Buddha. And really, I think it's, you know, a strong aspect of the Buddha's teaching. But just as it's developed, as our tradition has developed, this is something that has been emphasized very strongly, that all beings are at heart Buddha. We are Buddha nature at heart. This caused me to reflect on Reverend Master Jiyu's example to us. And also, you know, obviously many of her teachings are about this, but recently I had cause to talk with our novice monks about some aspects of the wild white goose. All of her disciples, Reverend Master Jiyu's disciples, are talking with our novices and bringing out some aspect of the wild white goose that resonates with us. And this was one aspect that I've thought about a lot lately, and that is, if you've read The Wild White Goose, most of you perhaps have, you know, this is the diary of her training when on her way to the Far East, training in Japan, being ordained and training at the monastery Sojiji in Japan. And she wrote it as her personal diary, not necessarily with the intention to publish it. Early on, you know, her disciples encouraged her to publish it because it was so interesting and so helpful. But she waited many years before publishing it because she was concerned that, you know, her attitude of mind wasn't always what it should be. And, you know, after years of training following this period, she felt she had to go back and look at it and re-examine much of what she thought and said. So if you read this, you'll notice that she has these comments quite frequently in some of her, where she relates some of her thoughts and her speech. She says, "This is non-Buddhist thinking." And she says at the beginning of the book, "Please don't read this book unless you read the footnotes, you know. It won't do you much good," because she didn't want people to, you know, get angry. She didn't want them to say, "Oh, look what they did to that poor woman," and, you know, "and aren't they, you know, et cetera, et cetera." We might feel that, but she didn't feel that that was really the most helpful thing to pass on. But, of course, she did pass on a great deal of amazing teaching that she received during this time. Another one, one of her other common footnotes throughout the whole book is un-Buddhist behavior and speech. You know, and I've read this many times, but recently had cause to go through it again, and I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I would kind of agree with that, but this is un-Buddhist, and, oh, okay. You know, so it makes you think, gosh, what am I, you know, how my some of my mental habits, some of my habits of thought go in that direction. I really have to be careful. So the point is that just, you know, points out the great humility that she had, you know, not only to publish this, but also to constantly re-examine her thinking. And I think, when I think of some of the wars and the way wars get started in our world, you know, how they have these entrenched tribal, you know, conflicts or entrenched ideas, whether they're religious or ethnic or cultural, whatever, and people just hang on to those, you know. And of course, some of them are valuable. You know, we don't want to just ignore them, but perhaps in our own personal lives, we can look at some of our own habits of thought, our own habits, ways of relating to others, relating to the world. Are there some precepts that we're skipping over maybe that we don't think are so important for us because we kind of dealt with that? Maybe look at it a bit more closely. Certainly my mind does that. I think Reverend Master Jesus' example is wonderful here. And of course, if you read the Buddha and any of the great masters, they spent their entire lives reflecting and examining their own behavior, their own thoughts, and revising, if you like, or letting go, perhaps, more to the point, of old stuff. And it's always the problem with reading these stories, Zen stories and the like, because you have a master at one point in their training saying something to a disciple, and people think, well, that's it, that's where the truth is. And then 20 years later, they say something completely different because they've learned a lot since then. And unless we're doing this practice ourselves, which we can do, we don't see that thread of training that goes through it and the truth that was true at one time and then the greater truth that is true at a later time. So, of course, most of you have read this, but just to give you an example, one that I just quickly pulled up this morning. She's Reverend Master Ji, who is now a novice monk at... a young monk at Sojiji, of course the only woman in an all-male, mostly young males as well, big temple. But she's loving the fact that she can now join in with the training. She says here, the bell went for the hour of working in the garden, work period, and we all changed into work clothes and went out together. It has never ceased to amaze me how these old senior priests rush out to do hard work, whilst many of the juniors have to be almost forcibly dragged. Little footnote, she says, un-Buddhist, this is non-Buddhist thinking. Okay, so, you know, think of how many times we might say, you know, under our breath, look at those, you know, whatever. Well, maybe we ought to just be still with those reactions and consider, is this Buddhist thinking? It might be an understandable thought. It's not that there aren't problems in life, but we don't have to allow it to become entrenched in our minds and then, you know, think of how what that can lead to. Here's another one. I wanted to think about the conversation we just had with one of her seniors, her teachers, being a bit annoyed with my fellow juniors who have done very little to be friendly in the past couple of months. She went off by herself to dig up weeds instead of joining the main body who were removing daisy roots in another part of the grounds. And you probably know this story, you know, she kept doing that thinking, I've got to think about the teaching. I don't want to work with these people right now. Well, here's another little footnote. It says, un-Buddhist behavior and speech. Okay. So, again, these are just really helpful examples and very kind of Reverend Master Jihu to show us, you know, be that transparent in her life. And, you know, as I mentioned, a very, to me, encouragement to humility and to examining some of these things that we take so much for granted. Well, of course you can grouch about such and such, but is that really appropriate? Is that helpful? What's that doing to my mind? What's that doing to others? And I think this ties into this very important teaching of ours of all beings are at heart Buddha. If all beings are at heart Buddha, then maybe I ought to look at the heart of that person that I'm grouching about. What are they really trying to do? What are they struggling with? Yes, they might be able to do better, but what's really going to be helpful to them? How can I help them or their Buddha nature to become manifest rather than how can I help them get in line with what I think they ought to be doing? You know, but this is such a common thought. I mean, it's embarrassing when I think about how many times this, you know, occurs to me in various ways, and I have to just catch myself and say, wait a minute. So this leads us to the last one, the fourth one, which is gratitude. And, of course, I'll tag onto that bowing. As you all know, we have this saying, as long as bowing exists, Buddhism will exist. And that is really the heart of gratitude. And it's interesting that gratitude is tacked onto this. It's one of the four fundamental teachings and practices. It's not just an emotion or an idea, but it's an actual teaching and an actual practice, gratitude. And again, one of those things, if you want to call it that, practices that, if we call it to mind, can change our perspective just so dramatically. Now, I won't go into a lot of detail on this because Rav Master Daishin did a beautiful talk on this just 2 weeks ago, and I recommend, if you haven't heard it, listening to that in terms of gratitude. And gratitude with a capital G. It's not just, it's not thinking everything's always nice and hunky-dory, of course. There is cruelty in the world. There is suffering. There is harm that can be done. But ultimately, we come to gratitude as an expression, as a response from our Buddha nature. And Reverend Master Jiu went so far as to say, her master and she taught that this gratitude in this way, this peace, if you like, which gratitude brings true peace, is a particular mark of our Soto Zen practice. And she actually said that it encompasses all of the four wisdoms. So if you don't know what to do, you ever feel confused, just bow. You know, that's the best thing to do. Stop and bow, and then something will happen. Something will open up. Even the most difficult things, we do learn to be grateful for. And rather than giving ourselves a very hard time about some of our faults, I have noticed the more I can sit still with a non-judgmental mind and just see what my mind is doing, I actually feel tremendous gratitude for seeing it. You know, I find myself going to my altar and saying, thank you for showing me this. I don't want to be like this. I don't want to keep doing this. And having seen it, I become freed from it. So even these faults of ours can be a source, and seeing them can be a source of gratitude and bring us to further training. And that is essentially those four teachings, which I felt, if you haven't heard them in that form, are really the fundamental, as I said, practices of our order, and are there for us at all times to practice, to come back to call to mind, and we pray and trust are truly the way of peace and the way of cutting through the difficulty and the impulses to do harm to each other. And I'm going to end with one of my favorite little passages from one of the invocations we chanted today. Reverend Master Jiu's adaptation of this invocation, I vow to thee, my country, the second verse she adapted. And there's another country I've heard of long ago, most dear to them that love it. Sorry about my voice today. Nirvana, all should know. It does not have an army, nor can be seen a king. Its fortress is a faithful heart. There ends all suffering. And one by one, and silently, its shining bounds increase. For its ways are ways of gentleness, and all its paths are peace. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.